When you may be God, but you still can't beat Houston. It's That's So MLS. With myself, Nick Thornton, and live in person with me is Andrew Bates.
Hey, Nick, how's it going?
Excellent, how are you?
I'm happy to be here at That's Some MLS West.
Yes, at our Western office.
Yes.
Andrew is out here taking in the sights and sounds of Vancouver. Got to see the Whitecaps game this last Sunday. We were both there.
I did.
How are you doing? How's the trip been?
The trip has been great. It's been nice to... to be in Vancouver, to see BC play, to go to an MLS game, because, you know, there's the...
Your second MLS game of the season, right?
Second game of the season, one win, one draw, so my record's pretty good.
That is pretty good, actually.
But yes, it was great. Attended the final game of the season against Portland, and then went to the end of season wrap-up media interviews on... Tuesday.
Yeah, which I mean, I guess maybe we can say a little bit about that now, since it's hot news here in Vancouver. For our audience that is not in Vancouver, you may just want to, well, wait actually until we talk about it more in depth.
Yeah, but... we've got some audio from it, and we're gonna talk a little bit about getting in depth to some of the stuff that was revealed. But I think that if you'd seen the last couple of Whitecaps games, it's clear that at times there has been. Since the firing of Coach Carl Robinson, there's been like a little bit of a passion gap. There was the 4-1 Rail Salt Lake game where we had commented at the time, oh, it feels like Tybert is the only one running.
Yeah.
And Tybert came out running in the press conference with his...
Oh, in the SKC game.
In the SKC game, he was, yeah, in the press conference, so... I think...
Well, maybe let's take a step back and just, like, set it up for us. Like, we will... In another episode, we're going to go in more depth.
Yeah.
But just, like, how did this whole thing come about? And kind of, like... For me, I'm sort of fascinated to know of just, like, walking into the room, what's the tone and kind of what's being told to the media in terms of setting it up.
I think that from the time of the period on, the coaches firing on, there's been, like, a sort of a tension or, like a little bit of a sadness around the... around the group. We talked to Peter Zimmerman, and he said it's a tired crowd. You know, there's a certain amount of fatigue. The game itself was pretty lively because everybody was very excited for Alphonso Davies. But I mean, I note this is not a critique of either group's approach, right? Mm-hmm. But it's like, you know, the curva was like, wear black because the season is dead. Mm-hmm. Like there is very much some like some negative. There's like negative energy, and I feel like it was kind of like that. Like people came ready to, you know, seek accountability to a certain degree. And we had said, you know, I think that, you know, after that sort of Kansas City game, it's like, imagine how Tybert must feel. And he let everybody know how he felt when he came out, because he sort of talked about like, the idea that there are only a few players on the team that are really playing for the crest and really like, understand and care about what it means to be a Whitecap, and that there is a big divide in the locker room, and that sort of created that sort of heightened the tension where every player that came after Tybert was asked about these same questions, asked what they thought about the divide, asked sometimes who they thought was on the divide, and you got the sense, I think, which was weird because it's like it's a press conference set up. There's like sets of three chairs on each side and TV cameras and stuff like that. And the players will come out of sort of the back offices, sit at a table, and then go back out and they'll bring in a new player. I feel like the other players were reading on Twitter. Like I feel like the players came down with like a knowledge of whatever somebody had tweeted about the person that came before them. So like people were already kind of like hot a little bit.
Is it just me, or is this always done where they do like 25 plus minutes with each player? Because that seemed kind of odd to me too, that there was about five or six players, well, six or seven players that spoke, and each one is 20 plus minutes. That seems like an awful lot of availability. I don't know if it was just a virtue of how much they had to say, or if that's the availability they usually give. But I was quite surprised that I was like, well, you guys must have all been there for several hours.
There's a lot to play. There's a lot to say, right? It's very, the way the season ended, because the team had a lot of promise, it wasn't like they had a terrible year, right? If you think about it, they only they only finished like 2 or 3 points out of the playoffs, right? Like it wasn't. So there was a lot of sort of frustration among people. I think that what I had experienced after games before is a dual approach where there is a little press conference. It was set up very similar to a post game press conference. Where they will bring out the coach and like 1 or 2 players, and then everybody will go to the locker room and talk to whoever they want to talk to, or scrum whoever they want to scrum.
I see, okay.
But I guess they, I left a little early, so I don't know if they ever did go any like go outside the room. I think there was opportunities for people to do one-on-ones or scrums after all the main appearances.
Yeah.
But like, I feel like instead of trying to do that more sort of free-flowing, like, sure, guys, come in, whatever, talk to whoever they want. It was kind of more of like a we're going to do the press conferences, and then the trade-off is, like, we're going to talk as long as people want to talk.
Right.
Right? Because there was no... in my,
it kind of felt like more of a post-mortem than a like a press conference.
That's absolutely what it was, right? And in there was no point where anybody intervened when I was there to be like, okay, we're done.
Yeah.
Until people didn't have questions.
Right.
Right? Like everybody talked as long as people had questions.
Do you think that was part of the strategy of to offer some catharsis, knowing that many of the folks in that room are also Whitecaps fans and season ticket holders and part of supporters groups? Do you think that was part of a, if we let everybody air their grievances, then they'll get it out of their system and forget? Or
there's a aspect to that. I think that it is still pretty professional in there, but the grander problem with accountability in the Whitecaps, and this is one that makes the discussion around it so hard to manage or think about, is, you know, people are trying to say, well, this is the coach's fault. This is X player's fault. This is the front office's fault. And sometimes when they're talking about whether or not it's the coach's fault or the front office's fault, they're working on whatever their understanding of how that relationship works.
Yeah.
But to a certain extent, it's a black box. I wasn't at the Leonard Juzy talk, so I wouldn't know sort of how that is. But certainly I feel like you talked in the players' part. The players were a lot more candid, I think, than you expect players to be. But largely, But largely, it's like, you know, none of the people that were there that were on options had any idea or anything. Just like that, they don't largely have input into how the team is run. They don't even have you know, Kamara is like, I would like to come back, but I won't force it.
Right.
He doesn't know if he's coming back anyway. So it's like, I don't know how much accountability you can get from a player, because the player isn't.
Well, and that's the thing, is I'm wondering if that's part of the strategy to take some of the heat off the front office. It's sort of like, we'll let them rip each other to shreds and let them bear all.
Yeah.
Because then it becomes this locker room problem, which even in Leonard Doozy's thing, he sort of mentions is a thing. And I imagine that's what so many people are starting to take to task. But, I mean, we're not going to get into all that nitty-gritty today. But we did want to let folks know that we've got the audio from it. But, I mean, if you're a Whitecaps fan, it's available, and probably by now you've digested every second of it. But we're going to sit on it for a little bit, think about it, and then try to frame it a little bit next week in a way that, you know, after tempers have cooled a little bit and we start to look ahead at the 2019 season, and then, of course, be sharing some pieces of that audio for you.
It was a really interesting experience. And you got to see sides of people you don't always see.
Yeah, I mean, a standout for me was, and again, I'm sure people have listened to it by now, is just Felipe talking about the stuff that's gone off the field. And
that was really hard.
I'm glad that so many people have taken note of this, is that, you know, we're rough on players all the time. That's our job.
Yeah.
But the amount of criticism that can be leveled at a player without understanding the other types of things that have gone on. And certainly we've been critical of some of Felipe's performances, considering there seemed to be this, he was such an electric key piece of New York Red Bulls and then came here and seemed to struggle so much. But I don't think, and even as he said, I agree, like, I don't think anybody can fault his effort. He didn't look like a lethargic player. I think we've talked about the ways in which he was deployed basically as a center defensive mid alongside Juarez really was not effective and didn't work, but
he brought that up when he's like, when he talked about his goal, he's like, yeah, I like to play my position.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that was our sort of thing, is like, why do you bring in a assist king like Felipe to be a holding midfield? Mm. So, but at the same time, it was a good reminder of, you don't know what's going on with players off the pitch, and you do need to, respect that. And I think for me, that's actually maybe a way of thinking about the whole thing, is that, you know, right now there's a lot of tempers that are still hot and a lot of people that put a lot of things into it and a lot of players that probably didn't or felt that the other players didn't put in as much as they could. But, you know, at the end of the day, we don't understand their world and how much work or effort they put in. Yeah. And maybe they don't always understand it of each other either. But I appreciated that. I think, you know, Felipe's comments were obviously, that was a really hard thing to do, to come out and talk about. I still feel as a league, we need to stick together, because it's so apparent to me anytime I go and talk to a Premier League fan or a La Liga fan that MLS is just not on the radar and people aren't watching. And so the criticisms they have are still kind of against the like 2001 to 2006 kind of MLS era. Absolutely. And Lord knows there's so many problems with the league that we discuss at length. But I do feel like it's a thing where, as at least, maybe not always as fans, but as certainly commentators of the game, we need to keep a broader perspective and make sure that we don't forget about the people on every team, and that we might hate Clint Dempsey, but he's just a guy playing football. Well, was.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that happened, do we want to talk about our experiences at the game itself?
We should talk about, we dove into the negative, but yeah. I feel like that's warranted at this point. But we should talk about what was an amazing send-off for Alphonso Davies. Build is such and very carefully crafted to be that, but I did feel like had genuine moments of an opportunity for a city to say thank you, and it felt like meant to be a send-off.
The last time that I saw Portland in Vancouver was not last year's season send-off, but I believe the 2012 season also ended with the Portland game, or the 2013 season also ended with the Portland game that I was at.
Possibly.
And that was a loss. This was, I feel like, a really, really memorable game that I've been told was like a little bit of a pickup in terms of attendance and, mm-hmm. and certainly like crowd attitude that a lot of people will remember. Yeah. If they went to it.
Yeah, and I felt that way. I was amazed at how many people came out on a Sunday afternoon, which is a weird time for a game that meant nothing. Doesn't mean nothing, because I think that's underselling the Cascadia rivalry, that even when we're out, there's still a good Portland contingent that came up for that game.
Yeah.
I think it's also apt to mention that Portland rested every single one of its starting players except for their goalkeeper, Antonella.
Armenteros.
Oh, Armenteros also played, yes, that's correct.
And I think Asprillo was on there as well.
Asprillo was on the bench.
Oh, yep. On the bench, right.
But basically, this was a B team/C team, which, to give Portland some credit, I don't think this was this game means nothing. I think this was we're heading into the playoffs midweek, because they are currently playing Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
We got to rest some of those players, and also, the playoffs, anything can happen, and you need depth of squad. So why not test out some players for 45 minutes plus that have maybe only had a smattering of minutes here and there? So I thought that was actually a really clever move by them.
Yeah.
Obviously, it meant that Vancouver really had this game to lose. Like, that being said, there's been plenty of times where Vancouver's faced weakened squads and come out non-victorious.
Right, because it can affect your mental state. You're like, oh, well, this will be easy, and then you don't take it seriously enough.
Exactly.
I liked it. I thought that Vancouver showed a lot of good offensive ability. There was a lot beyond the the absolute pandemonium with two Alphonso Davies goals, which you could not like script. The game was, I don't think it's in you know, an exaggeration to say the game was all about Davies.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
In like the fact that he's not only did he score, but he scored twice. Both goals were sort of the like created a dominating, like put Vancouver on a dominant edge that they kept throughout the game.
Absolutely. Well, I just thought of a thing, but I don't want to lose my train of thought here.
It was 28-31 was when he scored. Yeah. Both sort of on the. Both on the other end of the field, so I did see the replays.
Yeah. No, the goal in the 28th minute, I felt like that was a classic just all Davies thing where he gets into a burst of speed and you just go, there's no, he's going to do the right thing here. He's made it past every player. He's going to muscle his way in and take a shot. I was actually surprised. I thought it showed a little bit more preciseness than we've seen from him at times. We know he can dribble past players, but Antonella actually gets there to the ball, but he just hits it so hard that was exciting to me to see a different part of Davies' game, that the execution at the end of such a good run. The goal in the 31st minute for me is just an opportunistic poaching moment where I didn't get the player's name, but just someone gets caught sleeping on the ball coming out and the defender just really bungles it and Davies pounces on it, picks it up and scores again.
There were a few, he could have had two or one or two more.
Yeah.
There were, that was the other thing that you'll kind of remember about it, which makes me think, you know, I don't think this is a negative. I think it is as a positive to the overall performance that there were a couple of moments where, you know, all of a sudden Davies is on a one-on-one. You think, oh my God, there's got to be a goal out of this.
Yeah.
But he gets tangled up in a player's shoes or, you know, Reyna puts it over or Kamara can't quite get it. But they all had, as much as it was Davies, the scoring chances were evenly distributed. My worry, of course, always when you are promoting somebody as leaving, you know, is
it's got a weird tinge to it, doesn't it? Like it just creates a kind of weird atmosphere.
It speaks to how people think about world soccer, that like the idea that the club would produce a player that could play for Bayern Munich.
Mm-hmm.
Canada could produce a player that could play for Bayern Munich is considered to be like a unique like opportunity success story.
Yeah.
But to a certain degree, they're not. It's not like they're not competing for eyeballs to a certain degree. You know, I don't. Mm-hmm. You. That's a broader conversation of whether or not, you know, as businesses, teams in the U.S. are competitive with teams in Germany or competing for eyeballs, even if they're not always like on the same level. But like, you know, it's hard to draw people by saying like, here's Bayern Munich's player. I talked to Zachary Meisenheimer, who said he listens to the show. Hi, Zach.
Zach listens.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Thanks, Zach.
And he was pointing out, you know, and I noticed this too. The fact that they were selling Bayern Munich jerseys in the Whitecap shop.
Oh God, I didn't see that.
Like, you know,
anything
like
to make a buck, right?
Yeah, and I mean, like, I guess that you're gettable. Like, there are things that you can go buy, but to a certain degree, when you think of like what a fan's, you know, a fan's dollars, a fan's time, a fan's like emotional investment.
Yeah.
I don't know that you want to be like, you know, placing a big Bayern Munich ad in every one of your matches. I think this wasn't so bad.
Fun. One of the things that stood out for me about this, and, you know, I'm sure now in terms of this postseason conference meltdown changes the color of it a little bit, is the video messages they assembled from former Whitecaps players to Alphonso Davies, which had an extra weird tinge to it. I mean, I was emotional already because his parents were there at the beginning, and like, it's a beautiful story. It's a great story. You can't not feel incredibly happy for the kid, and just and especially with that performance, just be like, this is an incredible soccer story. Regardless of, you know, of course there's weird layers to it, but it is an incredible story, an incredible testament to his talent. But to see Tim Parker, Jordan Harvey, David Edgar, sending these messages. And Kai Kamara actually had a quite touching one that was quite long, where it was clear that he was kind of getting choked up as well about it. It was nice for me, at least, to... It wasn't just a... I got a little emotional when I saw Tim Parker. But it does help remind you again of, like, you know, on the fan side of things and for how much we care about these competitions, that many, many, many of these players play together in different combinations. And so, you know, if, I don't doubt their loyalty to the club, but remembering that they are all professional soccer players who, for the most part, want each other to do well and succeed. And it, I think it says a lot about the type of person Alphonso Davies is, that, you know, guys like David Edgar, Jordan Harvey, Tim Parker are willing to take a few minutes to send him a message when they don't have to do that. And I'm sure the Whitecaps organization approached them to do that, but I wouldn't have blamed Tim Parker if he had just sort of said, you know,
not taking part in Whitecaps PR today.
Maybe I'll just leave this one. And so I think it says a lot about those guys, and it says a lot about Alphonso, and it was a nice touch, I think.
The evolution over the course of the last 2 years, and is that I feel like even last, like, he's always been a player to look at for sure. But what he was in this game, that I don't even think he necessarily was at the beginning of the year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's still a player who has so much future ahead of him and so much ability to change his game and develop. I never, like, at the beginning of the year, it's not like he was the lead striker. It's not like he was the lead goal scorer, the lead, like...
No, he's an exciting, pacey winger that you'd throw on for, you know, the second half to let him run and cause some trouble. But he was much a threat on it for assists as he was scoring.
Mm-hmm. The center, he's not the center point focus of the offense, but I feel like, you know, this is... And I feel like, the especially from a mainstream perspective...
Mm-hmm.
This is how people think of stars.
Right.
It's like, you are a star. You must be the one who gets all the goals.
Yeah.
And he's never been that way. But I feel like closer to the edge of the season, he did develop into more of, like, a key producer of goals for the Whitecaps. And this is final goal. It's like the end of that evolution to, like, he was the center. He was the center point of the offense.
And the thing is too, that, you know, of course we're all going to be watching far more Bundesliga than we ever did before, which is saying a lot, but, I don't think he's going to be that for them. And I don't think he should be. And I don't think that's necessarily his role. I think it speaks to how electric he can be and just the physical shape he's gotten himself into in the last couple of years, that we've saw this sort of gangly kid who's always fast as hell and could cause problems to this much smarter, stronger player. That's long, long, long way to go in development. But if he keeps going, could be a real threat. But I still see ultimately as a winger who's going to really threaten and get past really good right backs and cross amazing balls into the box.
Yeah.
And I think that's the important thing to remember about, as you said, in soccer stars, it's always going to be the goal scorers that are looked at as these, you know, these idols, but, you know, who's getting the balls into the box, who's beating those defenders. And as much as I know this is a blasphemy to say as a Whitecaps fan, he could make a really serviceable left back as well. And getting
he was using that position for Canada before, right?
Yeah, like, and getting up and down that wing, and it might feel like a waste of his talents, but seeing how he turns out at Bayern, I wouldn't rule anything out. That you might think, oh, it's a waste to have him as a defensive player. But, you know, when you have a player that has that kind of energy and speed, that could be a real asset as a defensive player. And hopefully, and maybe to his credit, he'll be able to do a bunch of those things. But it seems like Bayern Munich is actually now sort of, like, their social media has picked up with him. They're excited to have him. I doesn't feel like he's going to be a bench warmer there. It feels like he's going to be getting some first team minutes, and, you know, maybe he's not going to be the starting 11 every week, but I think we can expect to see him, you know, making some serious impact in games.
It's been reported that he's going to join up with the Bayern first team right at the end of the next international break, and begin I think it's like the end of November or whatever is when he turns 18. That was always like,
right. Yeah.
That was always like what allowed him to stay for the rest of the season, that he can't legally play for Bayern until a certain time.
Yeah.
Before that happens, he is going to start training with the first team.
Right.
So he'll be able to start getting like integrated, so that if they do want to use him in any competitive fixtures this year,
mm-hmm.
He will have some time to learn the systems, get established with people. And Stefan Marinovic is going to be in town, he says, so he might check up on him and say, hey, what's up?
Beautiful. Beautiful. And I mean, just, yeah, it was a really beautiful night for him. It was great. I stuck around after the match because typically after we win, a player will come over and do the Humba with a Curva Collective.
Yeah.
I assumed it would be Alfonso that would come over. It's usually, you can usually tell who it's going to be. And it was kind of great because as there's so much stuff going on, it's been all Fonzie for a month, right? Like, mm-hmm. It's been all about the kid. And, you know, there was a ton of presentations even after the game and media stuff. And I don't know how many interviews he did. And then he finally comes over, calmly climbs into the stands, and is just this 17-year-old kid again with a bunch of supporters. And that, for me, was kind of the touching moment. Is like, he's there celebrating with us, but there wasn't any ego to it. And you could tell that he was kind of soaking it all in. And also just a 17-year-old kid who enjoyed playing soccer. And that, for me, was kind of the best part of it, is just watching a kid enjoy being a soccer player.
He's also that sort of, like when I think of, you know, when I was in the
scrum. We're talking about him like he's dead.
No, but with the scrum that I went to with the Canada game last year.
Right, yeah.
When he's talking about, like, you know, playing FIFA or whatever else. I think he is, like, that kind of person inside where if he wasn't playing, he would be there with you.
Follow his Instagram. Like, I have to quickly scroll through it sometimes because it's just such a teenager's Instagram where, like, before the game, they were like, so were you thinking about scoring a goal last night? And he was like, I was up late playing Fortnite.
I feel like if he wasn't playing, he would be, like, you know, sitting along, you know? Like, he would be in the supporter section if he wasn't a player.
Absolutely. Well, and it's like the Ibra documentary I keep talking about. Like, that's him. This nerdy, gangly kid who just happens to be amazing at football. But you, when you see him at that age, it's just a nerdy kid who wants to play FIFA at home. Like,
anyway. Which is awesome. Best of luck. Best of luck to Alfonso.
Yeah.
Portland is now, despite their loss, has now made it into the knockout rounds. Do we know how they're doing right now? It's 1-0 at halftime for Portland, I see.
Yeah. Diego Valeri apparently scored a real nice free kick. So whenever you listen to this, this game will be long gone, and I'll just record it for posterity. But I favor Portland to win this one. I tweeted it out before he scored the goal, as well as Dallas, to me, has been a little too inconsistent, but we'll see what happens there.
We'll talk a little bit about, you know, the New York City game has already happened, but I saw a great take. I'm trying to remember who it was by. I think it was somebody who works for... I'll pull it up, but it's like the idea that they're playing these midweek games right on the heel of all these emotional season-ending things, and also on Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, we need to start rethinking of this play-in round as, like, you know, I brought it up in my piece for Howler, where they were saying, you know, where a coach had said, oh, well, the Whitecaps were competitive to get in the knockout rounds. And I feel like we need to start almost, like, rethinking our thinking around the knockout rounds, where it's like, does it constitute making the playoffs to make the knockout rounds? If you make one game that then you lose, did you make the playoffs?
Yeah, I mean, the playoff system in general is weird. I still am out as to whether or not I prefer that rather than to just know who's going to win the season early on based on points. Part of me likes the tournament style thing. Part of me is also like, MLS's marketing has come so far, but like, if you want people to care about the playoffs, why are you having Wednesday and Thursday night games? You and I have watched so much soccer in the last year,
yeah,
and care so much. We're not going to see any of these games. There's just no way.
I spent all afternoon wandering around Broadway looking for Halloween costumes. I just couldn't do it. It was freelance writer Caitlin Murray who tweeted this take about, like, you know, why is it happening on Halloween? Why is this happening?
Yeah. I agree. I think it does need to be rethought, and I would like to see the whole playoffs branded a little bit better. I think they're doing a better job of explaining kind of how it works. But even, I felt like, you know, I would have liked to have watched the New York City and Philadelphia game, and it was kind of undersold as like New York City's going to win. And from what I've seen of it, I was like, actually, Philadelphia kind of looked like they're playing uncharacteristically poorly, and on another night, maybe would have gotten something out of it. Also, Bobby Warshaw said that that stadium is the hardest stadium to play in MLS. And I just so desperately wanted to respond, yeah, because it's not a soccer pitch.
It's not.
You're playing on a baseball field. You're right. It's not, but it's not because New York City's good. It's because the pitch literally moves underneath you because it's turf thrown down over dirt.
Every time I think of this, the mental image from where I attended the game of Teixeira slipping on the base pad
and like seeing it crumple up like carpet. Oh dear. But so we do need to talk a little bit about sort of how we got here to the playoffs, because we're not going to run through every game because it's already happened. And now we're, if we can call it in the playoffs, we're in the playoffs.
Yes.
But there were some interesting games that happened.
Oh, absolutely.
So we don't need to run through all of them because a lot of the results don't really matter. I would think the biggest one, well, there's a few actually. For me, the one that stood out here was that Toronto beat Atlanta 4-1 in a season that could not have gone any worse for the defending MLS Cup champs to deny the most promising MLS team an opportunity at the Supporters Shield to just bulldoze them. What do you make of that? How do you place this game? What was this Toronto's last-minute rally? Did they always have it in them? Is it because Almiron is injured? Is it all of the above?
What's been really frustrating for Toronto in their like in their unsuccessful attempt to make it back to the playoffs is that there have been individual performances where you think, this is the Toronto Magic.
Yeah.
But there is kind of only one lineup and only one way that they've been able to recapture that magic. They haven't been able to modulate it or evolve or move into a different thing.
Yeah.
So like it speaks to their ability to perform well on the day.
Mm-hmm.
In two themes that we hit often, one of which is that anybody can, like, almost any team in MLS can beat any other team in MLS at mm-hmm. any moment, and one that you have advanced a lot, which is that Atlanta has got cracks in it. Atlanta mm-hmm. is a beatable team. If even if they've been so dominant this year, Atlanta is a team that can definitely be exploited on the night.
Well, and for me, the image I just keep thinking of is like Vancouver knocks out Toronto, Toronto knocks out Atlanta. You couldn't have three more different teams, three different parts of the table and styles of play just across the board different.
Mm-hmm.
That, and at the same time you go, but Vancouver cannot beat Atlanta. So it really is a perfect example of, like, that's so MLS, is that it just depends on so many different factors. But kind of shifting towards New York, surprisingly, they only beat Orlando 1-0. However, that was good enough for the best MLS season ever.
Yeah.
At 71 points, I believe it was in the end. And it's funny because looking back over the year, I feel like we've talked a lot about the weaknesses with the New York Red Bulls and maybe not been entirely looking at the big picture, which is that this team has also been incredibly resilient, and despite coaching changes, despite players shifting in and out of duties and injuries, has ended up in the place they are.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like they have been able to adapt to that coaching change. They have been able to adapt to like obviously Bradley Wright Phillips is such an important part of their team,
mm-hmm.
but like they've been able to adapt to him being there or not being there. They have other high points in their roster that are not necessarily him. Danny Royer being one.
I was going to say Royer is for me a big linchpin there.
The one point that I noted, it was I think Mike Martinego on Twitter had asked like, why don't we hear MLS promoting the fact that New York had this this record-breaking season? I think the way that they did TFC, with the implication that TFC was a more like marketable team for like in especially was marketable for Canada, and I feel like maybe being in Canada will influence that. But it's weird. It was a weird season because they weren't like dominant. In with TFC, it's like when last year, it's like when TFC came to town, it's like the great result would be getting a point off them, right? Like like there was. That was the...
To, yeah, not to interrupt you, but I just... Well, I am literally interrupting you. But I feel like... to me, they're sort of like the Chelsea of, like, 2009 through, like, 2012-ish. Mm-hmm. Of, like, they're not necessarily blowing teams out, but they're just quietly grinding out 1-0 victories. Or, you know, if they're playing a more difficult team, it's like a 2-2 draw or a 1-1 draw. And nobody really thinks much of it, and they're just sort of like slowly moving up the table, and then they stay at the top of the table, but and then they lose a game, and you're like, they're not that good because they're not blowing teams out. But I think that actually speaks to the quality of the league. That yes, we saw many blowouts this season. Unfortunately, the Whitecaps were on the receiving end of a number of them. We did one or two of them ourselves.
Yeah,
but it just shows that, you know, good soccer shouldn't be 5-1, shouldn't be 4-0. Good soccer should be 1-0, 2-1, you know, 4-3, then I'm starting to ask questions.
Right.
But you want it to be competitive, and, you know, the New York Red Bulls also have a very organized system, which means that sometimes the game plan is to win by one goal and is to hold a team for almost 90 minutes and get a goal in. And I think people forget that sometimes, that... MLS has this often sort of like smash and grab quality of just like any way, anyhow. And I think the Red Bulls have been much more calculated and stuck to that system, even with the coaching change. That is, you keep the back door locked. We concede as little as we can. We defend as a team and we wait for our opportunity, but we're also controlling possession. And that's worked incredibly well for them.
Yeah.
And
it's a winning playoff formula too.
It is, right? And especially if it's something that's going over two legs is... You know, if you go away and you can get the away goal and, again, keep things tight at the back, then all of a sudden at home your job gets much, much easier. I'm still not entirely sure if they're the team that goes to the final, but for me, really, in the East, you got to think it's going to be Atlanta or Red Bulls in the final.
It speaks to the awareness of the conferences, too. It's important when you think of points records being broken. The points are not, like, as much as we think of them as an accumulation stat.
Yeah.
They're kind of a zero-sum game. Like, you know, there's kind of a pool of points that speaks to not only how well you've done, but how well other teams in the conference have done.
Yeah.
Where it's like, what you see, the weirdest thing when you think of, like, a record breaking, oh, well, you know, the record for points was broken, was that Atlanta was 2 points behind them. You know? Like,
yeah.
And you've seen in the Eastern Conference, this is part of the issue with having a trophy like the Supporters' Shield with an unbalanced schedule. You see in the Eastern Conference that there are high highs and there are low lows. I don't know that it's as... I don't know that there's... The lows this year in the East are so low to explain truly why there are two teams on that record-breaking level.
Yeah, I feel like this... I felt like last year the Eastern Conference was way more competitive than Western Conference, and and this year it balanced out a little bit more.
All the West teams are in the middle.
Yeah.
And as a result, you know, we use points to determine this trophy, but it's like, can you say definitively that Sporting Kansas City is a 10, whatever the number is, a 10 points worse team than Atlanta or Toronto? Yeah. Because they're playing... different opposition, the opposition that may be more competitive.
It's true. And I mean, I would love to see more matches. I mean, I know it's logistically kind of impossible and teams are already strapped for travel, but to me, the East-West thing is always the interesting matchup. I just hope the good, interesting teams go through. Another interesting result, and this actually did have implications, is New England beat Montreal. And New England was out already, I believe. And then I think this one clinched Montreal being out of the playoff spot as well and seeing Columbus go through. So this is a... New England and Montreal were two teams we've talked about a lot as potentially clinching a spot. And...
Yeah. I'm looking here... Just looking at that last... I'm looking at only some of the results from that last weekend. I feel like regardless of whether or not you're out of the playoffs, playing at home on your last day really benefits you.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fair to say.
It was just, it was only the LA Houston that was an away one out of the list that I was just looking at on your computer screen.
Yeah. So, and that to me is kind of the last one that's really the only one worthy of talking about that seemed to matter is, when we started the show with it, is, you know, Ibrahimovic has been such a boon to MLS this year, and we like to have fun and at his expense, but clearly has reignited some interest in the league and scored some fantastic goals and at times carried LA Galaxy across the finish line. But this, to me, was a perfect example of how LA for the last 2 or 3 years has looked much better than they actually are and shows that really any team can beat them. What do you change at LA Galaxy? If you're the manager tomorrow, something's not working. Who goes or what changes?
I think one thing that you look at with LA in DC once they added their big designated player acquisitions. Mm-hmm. This is LA Galaxy is the quote-unquote trope namer for this. Mm-hmm. In terms of a team that acquires a huge player but needs 1 year or more before they can truly be competitive. DC was able to get over that hill and make it into the playoffs. But LA has not necessarily, you know, even though they have, you know, had a turnaround in fortunes to get to this point from where they were earlier in the year and where they were last year. They've certainly done better than last year. Mm-hmm. But there he is. As much as I think that Zlatan has been a success and that he's working with the people he's playing with, he's clearly not at it alone, and he's clearly learned to cooperate with his other teammates.
Yeah.
But when you talk about spending, I would say that some of the to a certain degree, the core of the team mm-hmm. Was centered around the Dos Santos brothers, and they're both still there. But the team's era has moved past them. Dos Santos was there. Like Giovanni Dos Santos played and he started. But, you know, that team is so much more about Kamara and Ibrahimovic and Alessandrini and Boateng now than it is about Giovanni Dos Santos, who is at one point one of the world's most like eagerly talked about young players, or at least one of Tottenham's. Mm-hmm. The team is carrying, I'm not necessarily going to say dead weight. I'm not going to say that Giovanni Dos Santos is a dead weight player.
I'll say it.
But, like, you know, the theory of the team, like what the team is about and how it works, is moved past some very high salary players that are on the budget at LA Galaxy.
Yeah, I completely agree. And while in the short term it might have served them well to have such a high-profile player, I just had a moment where I was like, how many goals did Ibrahimovic really score? And I was like, oh, 22. Well, that's short memory on my part.
He definitely had a successful first season, even though they didn't make the playoffs. It's not like he was a bust. It's not like he was...
He did real well. But the reality is I don't think he's going to be back next season. And
no?
I mean, there's rumors swirling.
If you look at MLS history, you shouldn't expect somebody to paint out on season one. So I would think that if the goal for Ibrahimovic was to make, in addition to winning, mm-hmm. let's suggest that there's a possibility that he wanted to boost his worldwide popularity and make himself more of a mainstream star mm-hmm. by playing in LA. I think that, you know, you do have to kind of win. If you want to be known as this winner, you have to win, like, the league title in the place where you play.
Yeah.
And, like, so the question is, is, you know, his job over in terms of the goals that he set out for himself in the U.S. to accomplish if he just had, like, a good year and a couple of spotlight goals? And then he can think, well, MLS Cup doesn't matter as much to me as winning, like, you know, the French First Division or the...
And I'm not going to claim to get inside the head of the chosen one, but the trophies matter, but also I feel like if he leaves at the end of the season, he'll say, well, I came in and I scored 22 goals and the team still lost. Look at everything I did for them. He's done that before. This is not a... I don't think he has any tremendous sense of loyalty. I think if he mm-hmm. leaves at the end of the season, he won't see it as a personal career failure. Even if he'd scored 10 goals, I don't think he'd see it that way. But clearly he's left his mark on MLS, excited a few times. But if a Turkish club, a Chinese club, an English club approaches him and makes an offer, I think he'd take it in a heartbeat. Because the way the club has built themselves is not conducive to making the playoffs, because they pump all their money into two or three attacking players, and they have this just gaping hole in midfield and defense.
If I thought he was going to leave, or if I thought he could leave and I was the team, I would have done a better job constructing a space shuttle to which you could attach the booster rocket that is Letan, and then like enable him to power the rest of the team to heights that when he detaches and goes off to wherever he's going to go off to, you can build on that momentum. And I don't know that they've done that this year.
Do you feel like it's fair to make a Chicago comparison of what Schweinsteiger brought to Chicago in the first year there? And then like Schweinsteiger's performance, I would not say has dipped significantly, but they didn't build a team around him.
Mm-hmm.
And so they ended up at the bottom of the table, and it wasn't because they had bad players or Schweinsteiger was crap. It was that they didn't actually consider like a plan going forward. That if your best player is in their mid 30s, like there's only so much they can do. Even if they're great, even if there's Zlatan, even if they're, part of me is now thinking about DC, is that sure, Rooney's clearly got gas in the tank and I think could have a really productive year next year. But if he gets injured, do they have somebody to fill that hole? They've got great attacking players, but do they have the same type of player that's going to be able to make such a difference that could mean 9 or 10 points, which can obviously mean a playoff position or not?
I think DC have the DC have done something a little different where they have the Rooney for Maddox sub.
Yeah.
And when they, because they've designated him so like clearly as like a lead striker,
mm-hmm.
if you feel that's correct. I think they've done something where they can swap him out, and obviously it's not going to be the same without him there, but I think that they have a plan B, you know. I think compared to other teams that have built themselves around star players.
Well, and their plan B is also they've got a solid defensive side.
Yeah, that's right? True.
Like, their plan B is they actually have a good team.
Mm-hmm.
And where they were beaten early on in the season was also they were playing in basically like kids' water parks.
Just think of the difference. Wow, that's right.
They were literally playing in like a public park one week.
The Wake Med Soccerplex.
And changing in like a, you know, a public washroom. And then now they're playing in one of the, you know, smartest outfits in MLS. It's crazy.
More than anything, the regular season is over. More than anything, what will, you know, stick with me is how much teams changed over the course of the year. We'll be able to talk about this more, you know, as you know, when the playoffs come to an end in the current weeks. But, you know, from preseason to the first week of the season to the halfway point of the season to now.
It seems like 10 years ago, doesn't it? Remember when the Whitecaps went to Hawaii?
Oh, my God.
Ooh, there was a thing we forgot about the Whitecaps game, which was one of their most, like, clearly contrived storylines of that whole match, was Alphonso Davies subbing out for the new bright future of the Whitecaps, Simon Cullen. Who came on and within 2 minutes nearly has a goal for himself.
I didn't mention it earlier because I thought I meant to bring him up, but he had a couple of those minutes where he's like, you know, bearing down on the goal, and he's clearly the next project. And it's like, you know, it's like when Tottenham will, in the last game of the season, Tottenham will wear next year's home jersey in the last game of the season. It's like, coming up next year on the Vancouver Whitecaps.
Yeah, exactly. There's a new kid in town. His name's Simon.
And there was a chant, like the Alphonso, one of the Alphonso Davies chants is, you know, he's one of our own, he's one of our own. Alphonso Davies is one of our own. They immediately started doing the same chant with Simon Collins' name in it,
mm-hmm.
instead, which is like clearly like you know, is picking up on that thread of continuity that they were trying to establish with that sub.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's interesting, too, because they're clearly two very, very different players. But I remember seeing... I knew the storyline leading up to the game and knew that he would be on the bench. And knew that Dalrymple spoke very highly of him and have sort of seen him kind of in glimpses through the academy system.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd had no real sense of what kind of player he was. And I see him warming up and you go, I mean, he does look like a kid. He does look like a 16-year-old kid. He's... But then see him come on the pitch and the way he commands himself and the way that he was getting onto the ball and creating space, you go, oh, like, yeah, he has a lot of development needed, but the kid is smart. He's a,
mm-hmm.
He knew what spaces to get into and looked very comfortable right away. And one of my worries was, like, okay, it's 2-1, you throw him into this situation, it's going to make some critical error and this messes up his whole career. Not that it was that worried about it, but...
There was an amount of trust.
There was an amount of trust and pressure put on. And in a game that was everything to do with Alphonso Davies, in a game that, you know, I guess you could argue was set up in a way that how could he fail? But it did feel like, you know, there was risk there to put him on.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we knew he would only get 5 minutes or so. But to show that quick glimpse and that flash, you go, for me as a fan, that's a thing I'm continuing to focus on. And as a fan of the league, I want to pay more attention to in the offseason is the youth development matters so, so much to teams. And clearly, mm-hmm. the teams that do the best are able to bring young players through. Whether or not they have a true academy system or not, there's a balance there, but there's an ability to bring fresh new young players in, and the teams that are doing well I think understand that very well, is that you cannot just buy a winning team. And you might be great 1 year, but if you don't have players coming up through your academy ranks and young players to fill positions and add depth, you're not going to last very long in MLS.
There's been reporting, some of it through The Athletic, that the system is going to change over the course of the next year, that there may be a possibility of the territories for homegrown players will go away. So teams will be able to recruit homegrown players outside of their like assigned zones. And it will be really interesting to see how teams take advantage of that. If it happens.
When you say assigned zones, what do you mean by that?
So right now it's like my understanding of it, not looking at the rules in front of me, is that each team has like the Whitecaps can't bring in a player from Toronto and be like, this was our homegrown player.
Oh, I see.
Right? Like the Whitecaps have a zone that includes Edmonton, I think. And like the teams have territories.
Gotcha. Right.
In which they have, which is kind of like how the system was built to be the end run around the draft. Because, you know, if you've got a draft and you have also universal academies, mm-hmm. well, then what's stopping you from just, like, signing all the... Or, like the two systems are not that complementary to have a universal draft and an academy system. So mm-hmm. I think that, like, territories was sort of the compromise, mm-hmm. where it's, like, you can have first crack on players in your area if you bring them into your academy and you start training them as a homegrown player. So if the removal, if it was to occur... The removal of those boundaries would allow teams, in the same way that you see happen in other, you know, footballing countries, to recruit players to their youth programs from wherever.
Yeah, which could be real interesting.
That's right. It requires a real like increase in spending, and you know the Alphonso Davies money is going to have to be spent in areas that aren't necessarily player salaries. So
well, and it can't be so.
Mm-hmm. And it, you know, you're gonna have to, if your area that you're scouting is now like all of North America,
mm-hmm.
you know, where people are looking, where you know that, you know, teams are sending the most amount of players, it's gonna change things.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, lots to think about. And the playoffs have barely even kicked off.
Mm-hmm.
So as folks listen to this, the games will have already happened, so you know the results. New York City today, this is Wednesday we're recording, is through beating Philadelphia, kind of uncharacteristically poor from Philadelphia, but that's okay. And then currently we're still 1-0 for Portland, so we'll see how that one shakes out in the end. But next week we will go into more depth about the playoff games. I mean, you can watch them, you know, you'll watch them, but we're here to add context.
And then, you know, we're weekly, and we'll be here to sort of talk about the... that and the whole first round next week. So
yeah, I don't think anybody's listening to this podcast being like, who won?
We'll have coverage.
I hope not.
We will have coverage of these games. I would say, just from what I'm seeing right now, we know that, New York City is a team that have weaknesses, but Philadelphia was not the team really to exploit those weaknesses. We know that Dallas is a team that has really dropped in recent weeks because they also have weaknesses and have been, you had mentioned they've been inconsistent. And Portland was the team to exploit, or it has been so far through 60 minutes, the team to exploit those inconsistencies.
Just for posterity's sake, because we can prove that we're recording, well, we can't really prove it, but we are recording this on Halloween on Wednesday night. Do you want to take a guess about the other two knockouts? DC versus Columbus and LAFC, Real Salt Lake, they'll play tomorrow. The podcast will probably come out just after that, but do you have a guesstimate for... who comes out victorious in those?
LA is playing at home, so I'm going to go 3-1, and then DC is going to be 1-0.
Interesting. You're going with goal score, too.
Yeah.
I don't want to just... I think the 3-1 result for LAFC is pretty accurate. I'll say 3-0 just to mix it up. Good, and Real Salt Lake set a weird but brilliant kind of season.
Lucky to make it into that final spot. But also they've done it. It's not locked. They've put themselves in that position. But you know, in terms of momentum, they don't have it.
Yeah, DC Columbus. I think a 1-0 result is fair. I'm gonna say 2-1. I think Columbus can get something on DC, but I think DC is probably the favorites there.
Columbus is gonna be a tough out, and I'm informed. I know it's the playoffs, so the stakes are low. I'm informed by that DC 0-0 draw that happened in the last week.
Yeah,
Columbus is a tough out, and DC can play defensively. So,
yeah, that one to me is going to be an interesting one, but possibly low fireworks, possibly added time to make something happen there.
Zach Steffen in a shootout,
could be.
It's true.
All right. Well, until then, where can we find you online?
You can find me online. At Team Bates on Twitter, www.team-bates.com. I am an editor at Howler Magazine, whatahowler.com. The issue 15, I believe, is ricocheting around the world as we speak. And you can find this podcast at thatsomls.com and on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Cool. And then you can find me. I'm not tweeting so much these days. I'm waiting until the dust settles at That's SOA MLS. But I am going to watch some highlights and some playoff action and tweet about interesting things coming up. Oh, we're also on Instagram as well. And people like it. Who knew? People like to watch soccer videos. And until next time.
If you were a knocked out team in the playoffs, as a Houston player was in 90+6, and you don't want to play... the first game of next season, do get sent off.